Welcome, everyone, to another broadcast of Aging Without Wrinkles on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can find them at artistfirst.com. And now, here's your host. It's Harriet Tramer.
It's no longer the case, but when the baby boomers were coming of age during the 1950s and 1960s, radio and television were central to their lives. Gary Berman has long written about this cultural phenomenon, possibly in the hopes of recapturing it. We'll find out more about that in just a minute, because he is our first guest this evening. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Harriet. Pleasure to be here.
Have you always been fascinated by the history or the cultural impact of radio and television, particularly by Beatlemania, or is that just an interest that came with time? What spurred you to write these books?
I think I have always been interested, even when I was much younger. I've always liked watching TV, but not so much in a passive way. I've always been interested in watching the credits at the end of a TV show. Who wrote it? Who directed it? That sort of, I don't know why, but I guess for some reason I always wanted to know more about whatever I was watching rather than just watching it passively. And as far as the Beatles are concerned, yes, I'm pretty much a lifelong fan. I've been told by my family that I was singing their songs practically before I could speak, so that goes back a ways.
Songs before you could speak?
That's probably.
Yeah, that's a good trick. I don't know if I was singing their songs before I could speak, but when I saw them, I couldn't speak. I remember that.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, what's going on here? This is something interesting.
Exactly.
Radio and television had a strong impact. Do you think their being engrossed in this media had a lasting impact upon them? Sure, it had an impact at the time, but a lot of things do, particularly when you're young. Do you think it has had a lasting impact?
Well, I would say to some degree. I think every generation is affected and influenced by what they experience as they're growing up in their formative years. So if you're a baby boomer of a certain age who was a kid around 1950 or the early 50s, I think that's when television became such a driving force in popular culture. So you couldn't help but be affected by it or influenced, even, I guess, if you weren't necessarily aware of it at the time. But that's where people started to go to for news events from around the world and entertainment and all sorts of things that wasn't really available to earlier generations in quite the same way.
Now, many baby boomers who felt they really weren't part of the group, and I suppose in some way every young person feels that, might have felt more embedded, more a part of the group, when television gave them something to share with their peers. I mean, you mentioned the Beatles. That's the extreme example. You may have felt like, wow, I'm not really part of what's going on, but they made you a part of it. Do you think Facebook and other social medias serve that same purpose for millennials, make them feel embedded?
I think it's become certainly an easier way for people to communicate with each other, and it's something that the millennials have grown up with, just as baby boomers of a certain age grew up with television. Millennials are growing up with the sort of social media that's so widely used now, and going back a generation or so, people who were of a certain young age when computers became fixtures in the home. I think every generation or every age group has something that somehow came along at just the right time for that particular age group. So they apparently are getting quite quite a lot out of it. And even I use, I'm on Facebook every day, and so it crosses, I think, generations in that way.
Except I think younger generation, they may view it as a socializing. At least some members of the older generation, they use it for business purposes. People run their business off Facebook, people of all ages.
Oh, true. Absolutely. I put in a pitch for my books on Facebook whenever I can. So, and ironically, it's already become the sort of thing that younger people look at as something that older people use. You know, teenagers today might be drawn more towards other things like Instagram and Twitter and things that perhaps people of my age haven't really gotten around to. So things are changing very quickly. It's almost difficult to keep up with.
Now, one thing is very, very different between radio and TV as it was broadcast when baby boomers were growing up and Facebook now. Facebook allows you to be active. You are Facebook. You put something up there, you are an employee, an unpaid employee, but an employee of Facebook. The same was not at all true about baby boomers. It was something that came at you, not something you interacted with. Not something you'd say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? You think that makes a difference?
I don't know. I think perhaps there. It depends if you want to think of it as a form of entertainment or a form of communication. I mean, Facebook can be both. The internet in general can be used for so many different things. I mean, even though I'm a baby boomer, I enjoy keeping up with certain trends that might be popular with the generation after me or something like that. Or I can go to YouTube and find an old TV series that I enjoyed when I was growing up, and I get a chance to experience it again through my computer. And so I think it can mean different things to different people depending on what their priorities are. Some people want to use it for their business, that's great, but other people might turn to it as a form of entertainment or a form of keeping in touch with a friend who lives on the other side of the country. So really the possibility, I know it's a cliche, but the possibilities are endless.
Well, also the possibilities of everybody knowing everything are endless. There are no secrets. It's everything is out there. Now, do you think that baby boomers might have gained a less than positive? We're talking about the whole thing of the baby boomers watching TV as an exciting coming of age. Do you think that there is another side of this, a less positive side? Do you think it acquainted them with gender or racial stereotypes? For example, pretty rare for classic television shows to depict women working as professionals. They were home to Cleaver with her beads and her dress and immaculately coiffed with the hair and the makeup.
True.
Do you
yeah.
think people learn, I don't know if I would say negative stereotypes, but stereotypes that may not be at all appropriate for most people's lives?
I think back then there were certainly women in the workplace, but as far as something like television was concerned, it was very, very conservative at the time, and women on TV you usually saw as secretaries or nurses or very traditional roles that it took a while for them to break out of. And I think television back then was a little too careful about being very bland, almost, I guess you could say, and not wanting to present women or minorities in a way that they feared might upset sponsors or people who supported the sponsors. And I'm glad that changed the way it did over time.
It's fascinating. If you watch, which I'm sure you have, old clips of Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet, the ads are right embedded in the TV show.
Yes, right.
You can have the same appliance as the Cleavers. Just call this number. Now, what's fascinating is Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet. Sure, the people who are in it were making a lot of money, were stars, but the people they portray are middle class. Now you get Keeping Up with the Kardashians and a lavishness. You really didn't get it as much back then unless they were satirizing somebody like Gilligan's Isle, the millionaire. It's a totally different viewpoint. The American dream, as it was portrayed back then, just isn't now. Times have changed in a very major way.
Well, absolutely. I think the big turning point to me was All in the Family. At the dawn of the 1970s, when there was a lot of social and political and problems throughout the country, and a lot of upheaval, and that show really brought the real world into the television show itself, and it allowed people to see people that were probably more realistic and closer to what they were experiencing in their own lives. So, I could go on and on about that particular show, but I think that was really a turning point where, to a great degree, television was not really so much of a fantasy world anymore. It brought the real world in, even in a comedy. I mean, you could laugh at something and see where it still had some social relevance or had a point to make. And I think from that point on, things really changed quite a bit on television.
Sure they did. Do you think that millennials miss something when they watch TV in their room or wherever they watch it? They don't even watch TV. They would stream something on their computers. Do you think they miss it when TV, when I was growing up, TV could become a family experience or a group experience. Do you think something is missed when somebody sits there by themselves and watches the TV, their screen, their computer screen? Is something missed?
Oh, probably. Yeah, I think I remember watching TV with my family, not all the time, and we obviously had different tastes at different times, and so, but there were programs that we liked to watch together and comment on it as we're watching. And it's a little more of a communal kind of experience, a shared experience. And, of course, that's missing when you're in a room by yourself watching something, and just on a basic human level. But if people want to discuss it with each other after the fact, or say, hey, I just watched this on my computer earlier today, and they could sort of discuss it on a delayed basis rather than having seen it together. So I guess, yeah, there is something to be said for a more shared experience. It's funny, sometimes when I'm at a restaurant, like a casual restaurant for lunch, and I see a group of millennials at a table, They each have their own smartphone out, and they're all either sending out a message or receiving a message or watching something, and they're not even speaking to each other, even though they're sitting at the same table. So that's sort of an extreme example of what things can become or have become for some. But I think it takes a while to really figure out the real pros and cons until it becomes a little more established.
Television is not only an entertainment media, but it's also obviously a commercial media. They're there to sell. Do you think something about television made baby boomers, the ads that were constantly pulled on them, spilled on them, do you think it made them more easily marketed? Do you think millennials are more skeptical?
That's possible. Back in the earlier days of TV, commercials, well, when a company or a product was sponsoring the entire half hour or hour of a program, you saw so much more advertising for that one particular product or service, and the commercials were sometimes a full minute or even 2 minutes long, and that's when times have changed since then, but that's when you really were bombarded by a sponsor's message for their client who was selling the product, whether it was a refrigerator or a car or whatever. So I don't know. It just seemed to be part of television back then, and I don't know if people were complaining about it quite the same way that they do now, the way I do now, I know that. I'm always complaining about all of the advertising and commercials on TV. But it's what keeps it running, for the most part, on commercial TV anyway. You can avoid a lot of it on the internet, but even there, you can't avoid it totally. But I guess it's going to be another couple of decades before a lot of that gets ironed out also.
With TV and radio, some of the underside of it came out, what was going on behind the curtain. With radio, it came out about payola. With TV, it came out that some of the game shows, shall we put it politely, people were given questions or people were kind of pushed out at the show's
right.
convenience. This became a great shock. Oh my goodness, payola. I thought that this is the shows the kids, the songs the kids really love, and that's why they're playing them every 5 minutes. No, it's payola. People were shocked, or at least pretended to. With the game shows, I believe there were even congressional investigations. Do you
right.
think people are as shocked, or do you think they kind of are saying, well, what do you think? What do you expect? Now that some of the undercurrent and the behind the curtain of machinations at Facebook are coming out, you think?
I think the world's probably getting more complicated over time, of course, and but just the examples that you mentioned yourself just show that it you can go far back in time and look at any particular period and see something that was going on that shouldn't have been going on. There probably has always been a darker side to the mass communication that we know of and that has evolved through the decades. So I don't know if people are really as shocked as they may have been by a lot of these things because it's maybe we've just gotten a little more cynical and have seen a lot of things go on that didn't seem like it should happen, but there's only so much control we have over some of what we see. And that's I'm not really sure what else can be said about that. But people seem to bounce back even when they claim that I'm never going to watch TV again, or I'm never going to the movies again because of this or the other thing, whatever scandal or whatever issue arises. But I think time sort of softens their position often. And if you want to experience something badly enough, you could overlook or just not let it become too much a part of the experience for you, if you can.
A bit of a ticklish question. You've written a lot about entertainment figures, comedians like Ed Wynn. Have you ever met any of these individuals, or would you even want to?
No, I don't believe I have. But I guess you might be referring to the saying that, you know, never meet your idol, because it can prove a very disappointing or even traumatic experience if they're not what you had envisioned them to be. So there are some people I would probably still like to meet someday or interview, because I think of myself as a researcher and a writer and a historian. So sure, there are people I'd like to, but I guess I have to some degree, not necessarily celebrities that most people would recognize, but celebrities to me anyway. Most of the time it went quite well. So I look forward to whatever other chances I may have in the future to meet some of the people that I've written about.
What have you learned about yourself in writing these books? You're going back to a previous era in a lot of cases. You were part of that era. What has this taught you about yourself?
I'm not really sure. I write books about things that I'm personally interested in and that I like to learn about. And then once I do, I like to share that with as many people as I can. That's why I write the books. So I guess I've learned about myself that I like collecting that sort of information and telling whoever might be willing to listen, hey, you might not know about this, but this is a very interesting thing that happened, and I think you'd be interested in learning a little about that. So I wasn't always thinking of myself as that kind of person, but once I started writing the books, I guess I realized that that's the sort of thing that I find satisfying, both for myself and whoever I might be able to educate in some way. So to that extent, that's what I've learned through the years writing these sort of books.
What have you learned about aging? You've written a lot about what people experienced when they were young. Do you think it is ever possible? I mean, people went crazy over the Beatles. They went crazy over this group, that group. Do you think that there is something when you're young that you will never recapture in terms of an excitement?
That's probably only natural. I think being young, you have a lot of energy, both physical energy and mental energy, and things probably affect you a little more deeply than when you get older. When I think about the Beatles and the book I wrote about people who are teenagers at the time when Beatlemania was such a worldwide phenomenon, they were telling me about the pure excitement that they felt, and it was just an obsession. But they were, of course, very young at that time, and even though today they're still fans and they still follow the group in that they might buy new reissues of albums or new books written about them. I think when you get older, other things become important in your life also. So you're not able to focus so much energy and excitement on any one thing. But I suppose that's the way of the world, really.
Gary, thank you very much for being a guest. And I'll end by letting you give a plug. If people want to reach you, how can they do that? Give us a plug, your website, whatever you think would be good.
My website is GaryBerman.com, two R's and Gary. And there you can see descriptions of the books I've written and a few reviews and photos of some events I've attended in connection with the books. And there are also links to Amazon.com from there. All of my books are available on Amazon. So if anyone is so inspired to try one of my books, I'd be very happy about that. And I would be grateful. And maybe, like I said before, maybe I could pass on a little bit of information to others. And I'm also on Facebook. I'm not really difficult to find. And that's my plug.
And in passing, I cannot help but mention one thing. You said the magic word Amazon. This is another example. Everybody's talking about Facebook. Amazon is another major example of how the whole communication process has changed. You didn't have to get a publisher. You are your publisher and put it up on Amazon. Very different world.
Yeah, well, I've published a few things. I've self-published a few things, fiction works, but it always is good to have a real publisher to help with certain books that can help spread the word that way. But you're right, bookstores as we know them may not exist for much longer because of things like Amazon, and that's too bad. So progress doesn't always feel like progress, but it's difficult to stem the tide.
And I don't think this generation is going to be lining up at the record store at the mall to get the latest volume.
Yeah, well, I do miss those days. I'll give you that much, yes.
Okay, Gary, thank you again.
And thank you.
Everybody stay tuned because there's much, much more to come.
Aging Without Wrinkles fans, this is Jordan Goodman, America's Money Answers Man of MoneyAnswers.com. And I bet you got a lot of bills from Christmas these days. People really went wild spending. The average person was spending 5% more than the year before. Overall sales online, like on Amazon, were up 18% over the year before. And most of that spending was done on credit cards. So very, very expensive. If you don't have the money to pay those bills when they come in, it's going to be very, very expensive if you have to pay a lot of interest on those kind of things. So here's some suggestions to get that under control a little bit. The first thing, you do not have to be having very, very high interest credit cards. If you have decent credit, you can easily get credit cards that are paying charging like 6, 7%, something like that, instead of 18 or 25 or some ridiculously high rate. A free website to get the best deals is guidetocreditcard.com. All the best deals are there. Low-interest cards, if you want to take a flight, frequent flyer miles. If you want to get a cash rebate, you can get like 5% cash rebates. If you've had credit challenges in the past, you can get a secured credit card where you put the amount of money in. You give them $1,000, they'll give you a $1,000 credit line. Whatever's best for you, I recommend you get maybe two cards. Concentrate your spending on the cards where you get the best rewards. Don't have 10 different cards with all kinds of rewards that you're never going to get around to, and that way you can do very, very well. And then you roll your balances down from the high-interest cards to low-interest cards and save yourself a lot of money. So that's the first thing. Go to guidetocreditcard.com to find the best deal in your situation. The second thing you can do, if you have a lot of credit card debt at high interest rates, is to use a national nonprofit credit counseling organization, because they will get you rates you can't possibly get on your own, typically like 6, 7%, something like that. They've already got deals with the big credit card issuers, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Chase, and so on. And so you would consolidate all your existing credit card debt into one at the lower interest rate, pay them, and they pay the creditors, and over 2 or 3 years you can get out of debt quite easily. It's considered a neutral on your credit score. Now, my favorite national high-quality nonprofit organization is called Cambridge Credit Counseling. Their website, cambridgecredit.org. Their phone number, 800-897-2200. They've been doing this for 30 years or so, and they have great relationships with all the creditors to get you rates you can't possibly get on your own. And again, it's considered a neutral on your credit score. So either getting better credit cards or consolidating with a high-quality nonprofit credit counseling organization may very well help you deal with all the bills that are coming in from Christmas this last season. Those websites that I just gave you are on the show notes, along with the Aging Without Wrinkles program. And you can also find out more about them at my website, moneyanswers.com. So hope that's been helpful to you in getting your Christmas bills under control. This is Jordan Goodman of moneyanswers.com.
You are listening to Aging Without Wrinkles on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can listen anytime. Visit artistfirst.com. Now back to your host. It's Harriet Tramer.
In our last segment, we talked about how times have changed in terms of media and how people relate to the media. They are also changing in ways that may be even more relevant. At one point, end-of-life issues were never even discussed or discussed only in very private circumstances. Now, however, 5 states plus the District of Columbia have death with dignity laws. Molly Graziano, who we will be talking with in just a minute, is working to get similar laws passed in Ohio. She was one of the founders of Ohio End of Life Options. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think before we even begin, people may have some great misunderstandings of just what death with dignity laws, what they mandate, what they allow, who they apply to. Could you help explain that? Because this is surely an issue about which there's some great misunderstandings.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely right. There are a lot of misunderstandings about death with dignity laws, and one of the first ones is the language itself. You know, you hear the phrase death with dignity, but also you might hear the phrase aid in dying, physician aid in dying, medical aid in dying. So that doesn't really help the situation too much with all the different phrasing that's out there. But one of the key points of any of the death with dignity laws or aid in dying laws are that this law will be only for individuals that are terminally ill. And sometimes people get confused and think that we're going to try to get rid of grandma. This could be make it vulnerable for people that have disabilities, and that's absolutely not the case. You must be terminally ill as determined by 2 separate physicians with a life expectancy of about 6 months or less, so similar to what they look at for a hospice admission. And the process is really driven by the terminally ill individual. There is a lot of time for thoughtful deliberation in speaking with your physician. So if someone were interested in this, one of the states right now, they would go and speak with their physician, say they are interested in utilizing the aid in dying law. That physician would have a conversation with them. They would need to be terminally ill. Then they would need to return 15 days later. So you have that, about a 2-week window. To hopefully, then you're engaging your family in conversation. When you have that first physician conversation, hopefully they're engaging you with a hospice program. And there's a lot of thoughtful deliberations. You go back about 15 days later, have that second conversation. You need to see a second physician. And even if you do get the prescription, that doesn't mean that you have to use it. I mean, some people use it, some people don't. Some people do end up, you know, dying from their disease and not using the prescription, or maybe not even getting it filled. But the big key thing is that it has to be, you have to be terminally ill, and it is very much driven by the individual.
Another thing people might have great, great misunderstandings about is the number of people who use these laws. They may figure everyone's going to try to get rid of grandma, and it's going to be hundreds of people a day.
It's unfortunate.
Any figures as to how often this has even been used?
Yes, there are. About less than 1% of the individuals in Oregon, and Oregon is where we have the most data from. But now that we've got these laws in other states, we're going to start getting more data and more interesting information, because we're going to start seeing what's happening in more diverse communities. Because, you know, one of the big keys with healthcare in general is access. So right now, Oregon is primarily a state of white individuals. So that's the data that we have. But we're going to start seeing California's data has come out. We're going to start seeing more from the District of Columbia. And I think that's going to give us a really nice picture as to who is using it. But it is used rarely when you look at the number of deaths per year. And the primary diagnosis of individuals that are using aid and dying is a cancer diagnosis, followed by a diagnosis of ALS.
I believe from what I've read, it may be less than 5%, maybe
less than
1%.
Yes, it is. It's like 0.01%, I think, of the just in Oregon have used this. So it is not a large number, and one of the things that you will hear folks in opposition say is this is going to be a slippery slope. Once we pass a law like this, you know, there's going to be, you know, doctor's offices on the corners where they're going to be doing this. And that has absolutely not, that has not bore out in the data that we've seen and the information in the states that we've seen. There's so much written in for the safeguards into the legislation. It is still a very personal process between the terminally ill individual and their doctor. But there is quite a lot of safeguards written in there. So this is a thoughtful deliberation written, you know, determined by that person. Right now, what you see, again, because of one of the accesses, is generally, looking at the Oregon data, you'd see an individual who is white, usually college educated, has insurance. But again, that's where that data from those other states coming in will give us a little better picture of what it looks like in a more diverse community.
If I understand that Oregon has not had the easiest ride in getting this legislation, I believe it was passed by a voter initiative in 94, and it was either blocked by the courts or, for whatever reasons, they had a revote on it again in 97.
Yeah. You know, anytime you're a trailblazer and you're doing something different, and that's what Oregon does, there's going to be challenges. You know, we're happy to say now that they've had the law for over 20 years. There have been no reported cases of abuse. They've got really good data to give us a snapshot of what's happening and how people are using the law. And they've really, the rest of the states in the country really have Oregon to thank for blazing that trail. It's really helped the rest of the states be able to articulate the message more clearly to their legislatures. Because really, at the end of the day, when you look at these laws that have passed, they've all had bipartisan support. And one of the things that we see, and when we talk with folks, is this is really not a partisan issue. This is a human issue. So right now we have the legislation that was introduced in Ohio by Senator Tavares with two Democrat sponsors. But Lisa Schattinger and I are really hoping that we can sit down with some of our, you know, some of the Republican legislatures, because I think at the end of the day, when you sit down and really talk with people, you really find out what their story is about what has been their experience with maybe somebody that they've loved and lost from a terminal illness. And maybe they would have, or that person would have preferred to have this option available, and unfortunately didn't have that option available in Ohio.
you seem to be reading my mind or understanding that I'm a little tired because I've been up early this evening. So you began to answer my next question. There are polls, and I'm sure you've read them more than I have. I just did some cursory research that indicate the majority of Americans favor, in some form, death with dignity laws. Why, then, is it that only 5 states and the district have passed them? Do you think it's just a matter of time till others will? Why do you think this has been so terribly slow when it seems to be something the majority of people want?
Well, you know, you had said earlier that, you know, we didn't used to talk about death and then, you know, we're talking about it now. But, you know, I go back to when my parents were young and, you know, when their grandparents died, they had their funeral in the house. And death was more a part of your life, you know, many, many years ago. And then we kind of sterilized everything and went into this death-phobic mindset where we stopped talking about our end-of-life wishes. I worked for 10 years in organ and tissue donation, and we found that to be true there as well. We found that people just have never had that initial conversation with their family. So one of the things that we think is important as part of this movement overall is getting people to be younger and younger and talking about what your end-of-life wishes are, talking with your parents, with your grandparents, whatever the case may be, because I don't think we do a really great job of communicating to our family and friends and our loved ones what our philosophy is of end of life. And I used to say to folks when I would be doing, speaking on an organ and tissue donation, I would say, you know, either you're going to make up your mind about how you want your end of life picture, or your end of life to be, or someone's going to make those choices for you. But I was constantly surprised at the number of people who do not have advanced directives. And these are adults with children in the healthcare profession. And I said, we used to say, it's not a great, you know, it's not a fun conversation, and I'm not asking you to have it every week or every day, but it is a conversation that people need to have, because I noticed when we would sit with families and talk about organ and tissue donation, if somebody maybe didn't have it on their license, they'd be like, but you know what, we were just watching a show, or we were just talking about this, and I knew this was what this person wanted or what they didn't want. And those conversations seem to come back up, you know, at times of tragedy and death and things like that. But you need to have advanced directives. Written down what you want, what you don't want, and communicate it to your family. I know a lot of my, you know, folks that I've spoken with will say, well, yeah, I've got everything. It's in a file drawer. Well, have you shared it with your children? Well, no, it upsets them. Well, we have to kind of get over that a little bit. We have to be able to sit in our own discomfort with this, because at the end, if you talk about it, most of the time people are able to exhale a little bit and go, okay, we had that conversation and I didn't melt. It's okay. So I'd like to see us encourage people to start talking about end of life earlier in life and realizing that death is part of the circle of life. It's literally going to happen to all of us. And you can have the ending that you want. I mean, some of us will not have that choice, you know, if you get hit by a car tomorrow or something like that, God forbid. But if you do have a choice, I think people should have a choice.
One thing that may affect this whole issue is medical advances. What happens? You say two doctors have to indicate before they can take advantage, for lack of a better terminology to use, of a death of with dignity law. Two doctors have to indicate an individual has only 6 months to live. We're moving quickly in some areas of medical advances. And isn't it more and more likely that doctors are going to say, well, you have a serious illness, but there's new things that seem to be working. So we really can't say you only have 6 months to live because, wait a minute, times are changing and you may live a lot longer than this. with this new procedure, new operation, new medication, whatever it is?
Well, that kind of ties in a little bit with the last topic that we were just talking about. And I think, yes, there is, we can keep people alive for a very long time, but we don't necessarily keep them alive well. And this goes where you really need to talk about, what does being on a ventilator look like, and do I really want that? Yes, there might be a treatment for this cancer, but it's going to decrease the quality of life that I have left while I'm here. My father, I took care of my father when he was dying of pancreatic cancer. And one of the options that they gave him was they couldn't do the Whipple procedure, but they could do radiation to help palliate any kind of pain or anything like that with the tumor. And my father said no. And my mother was, upset with him, but he said, I want to have as much quality of life as I can with the time I have left. So I think the conversation in healthcare today is really, what does quality of life look like for as long as you can have it? And that's really, again, where people need to stop and think about that. Sure, we can keep you alive until you're 105, but your quality of life may look like this. Is this how you would like to live? And if it is, then we'll keep you alive to 105. That's where I really think it comes down to, is what do I want my life to look like? And they're doing a much better job in healthcare now of training physicians to talk about end of life, because really we have done a disservice to a lot of physicians in that when they were educated in medical school, they were never trained how to talk to somebody about end of life. They're getting much better about it now, thank God, because it's such a profound time in someone's life. And it is part of a memory and a story that their family will continue to tell. I still remember when my dad was told that, he couldn't have the operation. I remember my dad's hospice nurse. Those things, when you're going through something like that, you are always part of that person's story. So I'm happy to say that we're getting much better about it, because I think it's okay to present options to people and then let them make the decision. But if you've never talked about end of life and all of a sudden you're 40 years old and you get a terminal diagnosis and nobody in your family talks about end of life, it's really hard to process all of that in the midst of also having this terminal diagnosis. People do it, and thank God we have amazing social workers and hospice programs that help people through that. But if you have a general philosophy of what you want your life to be and what quality of life looks like to you, if that time comes and you need to be looking at those things, it's not going to be easy, but it'll be certainly be easier if your philosophy kind of drives how you feel about things.
Now, if a doctor says, I know these are very tricky legal issues, I have no idea if they've ever been to court. If a doctor says, well, we can try this experimental procedure, it may work for you. It may greatly extend your life. If we don't do that, you have 6 months to live. Could somebody who has that type of diagnosis use these death with dignity laws?
Yes, because you always have the right to refuse care. So much like I said with my dad, he didn't want to go through radiation and have and be sick and everything else. He knew what his time left was, and he made a decision to not utilize a treatment that was offered to him. So if someone, I'm not a lawyer, so I want to be very clear there, but my feeling would be that if they are someone who is not interested in that procedure, but we also have people, we have one woman right now who is very active on her Facebook page, and she's a wonderful person who has allowed us to share her story a little bit. And she has a stage 4 cancer, and she firmly believes that she would like to have the option for medical aid in dying in Ohio when her time comes. But right now, she is doing an experimental treatment down at NIH. So it's not everything is on more or less like a spectrum. And, one of the things people will say was, well, why can't people just go into hospice and they can die in hospice? And absolutely, we are huge, huge, huge supporters of hospice, and I would like to see people referred to hospice earlier because I think it's excellent for both the patient and the family. I can't say enough good things about how fabulous they were when my dad was ill. But I think that people just need to realize that, you know, it's okay to still pursue treatment if you want to. If that means for right now your diagnosis will not be for 6 months or less, that's okay. Go pursue that treatment. That's really what's important to us here, is that every individual have that option. It's really about a personal option. For people to say, this is happening to me, either I want to have this option available, or even for people that maybe are like, that's not something that I could do, but I'm okay if people have the option to do it. One of the things that's been really interesting since the legislation was released is the number of people that we've been hearing from who will self-identify themselves as Republican, pro-life, whatever the case may be, a little bit more like you would not necessarily assume, but they're like, I want to have this option. As an adult with a terminal illness, a mentally capable adult, and again, you must be over the age of 18, you must be mentally capable, I should have this option. Whether I choose to use it or not, people should have this option. And that's really where we're coming from.
It will be fascinating to see what happens in Ohio, where you're working on this legislation, because it is very much, I guess you could call it a purple state. It has some areas very conservative, some areas much more liberal, and they sometimes switch back and forth depending on who the candidates are. If I am correct, Oregon would be much more of a blue state, much more homogenous and much more liberal. If this passes in Ohio, it will be one of the first instances, I believe I'm correct, in a state that's not identified as being a blue state. Colorado, maybe, either way.
Yeah, we do have pockets, and that was what was really interesting to me when the legislation came out, is that a lot of the comments in the Columbus area, they did quite a bit of media coverage on it. So I was monitoring the media coverage just to kind of see what people were saying, what everyone's thoughts were, and kind of looking to see where people lived. And I was heartened. I was really happy to see that people from the areas that maybe in Ohio would be identified as incredibly conservative really had positive comments on Aid in Dying in Ohio. The big key will be to get our legislators to realize that this is what their constituents want. And that's why we really need to reach out across the entire state of Ohio. We will travel anywhere. We really want to talk to people about this law, about this legislation, what it is, what it isn't, how it can be used, what options are out there for people. Because I think at the end of the day, we will get bipartisan support, but it's really going to be the constituents. It's really going to be those voters letting their legislators know, hey, I might be from a conservative area of Ohio, but I believe in this, and I want you to vote for it.
Molly, thank you very much for being a guest. And why don't you tell our listeners where they can get more information about your group?
Thank you so much. We are on Facebook at Ohio End of Life Options. And please visit our website at ohiooptions.org.
Thank you very much. One other thing I would like to remind listeners at the end of our show, thank you for listening. And if you go online to my website, Aging Without Wrinkles, or if you go to the archive page for my radio show, which you can easily do by going to artistfirst.com, scrolling down on the left side till you get to my show, Aging Without Wrinkles with Harriet Tramer, you can be connected to Amazon, where you can just go on Amazon, and I think you will enjoy my book. Maybe enjoy is the wrong word. I think you will find it very instructive, Rounding the Circle of Love. Thank you again for being a listener, and I will hope you continue to be a follower of our show. Thank you.